Hello, everyone. Welcome to AJ's Analysis, the podcast that talks about the past. Today, I am having a conversation with Bobby Cochran. Now, we had a great conversation about Eddie Cochran, his life, as well as talking about life now and, well, everything, really. Thanks for joining me. So, for the people that don't know who you are, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Bobby Cochran. I play most types of music. Rock and roll being probably the biggest influence, rockabilly, of course, blues, some classical, you know, I do a lot of fingerstyle stuff, all that Chet Atkins and kind of a mixture between Chet Atkins and Jeff Beck and B.B. King and, you know, a lot of different styles, yeah.
Nice. So you are a part of a band now, or how does that work right now?
I have several bands. I have bands in England and Sweden and California and Nashville.
So how did that happen? You just start with one, or how'd that happen?
Well, I lived in California all my life, so I know thousands of musicians out there. Have had shows in operation most of my life on some level. So anything from a trio on up to 8 or 10 pieces is not uncommon.
Wow.
And then when I tour Europe, you know, I put together bands for those tours, and so all those guys are there. And same thing in Sweden and all over Europe, you know, we tour all over there. And since I've lived in Nashville, I've put bands together here too.
That's awesome.
I do a lot of solo stuff, some duo stuff, trios, quartets, 5-piece, 8-piece, 10-piece. Just depends on what the budget is, you know.
So you've toured around, like, the world, kind of?
Yes.
So how did that whole thing happen? Did you just decide, like, that you wanted to tour, or how did it happen?
Well, I've been in, you know, some famous bands and, you know, worked with a lot of famous people and endorsed a lot of products through my life. Ibanez sent me to Japan in 79, you know, and I toured over there with Alfonso Johnson and, what was his name, the drummer? Oh, it's escaping me right now. hilarious guy. I'd have to look it up to remember what his name was, but they sent me on tour all over Europe, yeah, along with Billy Cobham and Alfonso Johnson, and eventually, well, they introduced me to Bob Weir, and I started working with Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead, and then we toured over there, and I started spending more and more time there. I was invited over to England to play an Eddie Cochran festival, and a fella met me while I was there and decided that he wanted to fund having me come over there every year for the next 10 years, and I said, well, you'll need to find me a band and some gigs. And so he did. And the band he found was Albert Lee and Hogan's Heroes. And the bass player from that band liked the material he heard and wanted to put a band together for me. And after he played with me, he said, where have you been hiding? Why haven't I known about you? And he said, I met Albert 14 years ago, and we've been touring all over Europe. And Albert at the time was playing with the Rhythm Kings with Bill Wyman's band and backing up the Crickets and the Everly Brothers sometimes. And the bass player, Brian Hodgson, from his band, said, if you'd be interested, I could plug you into all the promoters we use with Albert. And, you know, so he did, and he opened up all of Europe for me.
Wow. And, so when you guys do live shows, is it, I've seen a few different live performances of yours, and I see you go with Summertime Blues and then La Bamba. What else usually do you guys play? Because I've seen those two.
Well, it just depends on the gig. You know, I've headlined blues tours, I've headlined rockabilly tours, I've headlined rock and roll tours, I've got a lot of original music. I've got a lot of music by other people that I've, you know, sort of developed my take on it. And of course, a lot of Eddie's music. I generally will do 20 Flag Bomb, something else, which my dad wrote with Sharon Sheely. I was pleased to do Three Steps to Heaven with the Crickets and a Cochran Festival, Sonny, and the guys, or some of the guys played on that last session that Eddie did on Three Steps to Heaven. Yeah. And so to revisit some of that with them, and it really just depends on the gig. You know, I have a whole array of songs that I've done most of my career, and originals that come up. I wrote a tune when I was over in Sweden, and Brian co-wrote on it with me, and he presented it to Albert. Albert decided to do the song. And then the producer called me and said, Bobby, can I send all the tracks for the demo over? Because, you know, some of Albert's band had already played on the demo. And when he got the tracks, he heard my singing and my guitar playing on it. And he said, God, that's a hell of a guitar solo you put on that. He says, I'm going to ask Albert to keep it on his record. And he did. He kept my solo on the record. Of course, there was lots of room for him to play, too, so... I wrote the song purposely for guitar players, you know, to do a lot of hot rod on it, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I've seen, like, on, like, Spotify and stuff, I've seen a few songs, like the Goodbye Lorraine and Don't Think Twice. Was that specifically you, or was that, like, a group of people? Because I see, like, a few headliners, you know.
That was my band. We were on tour over in Sweden, and the promoter liked to put compilation albums together, and he used my track on that Bob Dylan tune, along with other American artists. So I was one of a compilation of many artists.
I see.
Unfortunately, they mixed it. I had sent the effects channel too, but they didn't use the effects channel gently as it was intended. They had it turned all the way up, and like, and it was, you know, nothing like what I would have wanted. But that's just a difference in perception, you know. I guess if I'd have been involved with the production of the final product, I could have controlled that for them, or just sent them a final mix. You know, I would have preferred to have done that. Goodbye, Lorraine. You know, we were on tour. Every time we toured over there, the promoter would take us on the studio and try and get us to record something for somebody, and in addition to that, we'd record something of our own, you know. So I think I wrote that song, now that I think of it. And he'd often just want me to write something, you know, and be in the studio and just include it with what we were doing, you know.
Mm. Makes sense. So so with the different songs that you guys have, I guess, done or toured around, do you have a specific favorite of, I guess, Eddie's?
You know, I like all the material for the most part. There are songs I never that fond of, but for the most part, I just love Eddie's material, and ate up pretty much everything I ever could get of it. I helped Rockstar Records to understand that there were tracks out there that nobody knew about, because I had heard them when I was young, and he was able to find most of those tracks, including the tracks that Eddie produced on my mom. My mom would have been tickled pink to be on a CD with Eddie. She was a great singer, and Eddie produced her with the intention of seeing if there was interest in, you know, having another Julie London type artist.
Mm.
My mom was a very good singer, and introduced me to a lot of variety of music. She was into jazz and blues and stuff on a pretty big scale. She was a trained opera singer. When she was 16, they touted her as being the next Lily Pons, because she had a range that was a little bit higher than Lily Pons, and of course is what Lily was famous for.
Wow. And what about your dad?
My dad was a great songwriter. He wrote Three Steps to Heaven with Eddie, and co-wrote something else with Sharon. I finished some of the songs that he had started. still got more songs that he had started that I'm going to finish. And he was a very talented, smart fellow. He had a terrible problem with alcoholism, and he really just let that kill him. You know, he died when he was 50 years old from alcoholism, basically.
Wow.
And that's part of why I never drank and never did drugs. You know, I just didn't want anything to do with it. Messing my life up the way it messed his life up and my mom's life. You know, it was a terrible way to grow up in a family with an alcoholic in charge of working and feeding you, you know. And we went hungry a lot, you know.
Wow, yeah, that's a lot. So, well, after Eddie died, how did the whole family, I guess, react?
Well, that, in my opinion, that pretty much destroyed the family. The way they dealt with the loss of Eddie was so unhealthy. Going and visiting Granny was kind of a combination of terrible and beautiful, you know, and I loved her, but life was so focused around Eddie that it was just unhealthy, you know. The house was dark, and it just was, it was a terrible loss, you know. My dad is one of the people that identified Eddie's body when they flew it over here before the funeral, and I don't think that memory ever left him with anything good. You know, he was just a horrible experience for him, and his drinking, from my experience, and of course I was older after that, and it just got worse and worse and worse, you know. And the family had a history of alcoholism, and it's a shame that it was affecting Eddie already at 21, you know. And Eddie had some difficulties when he was on tour, and you know, I told a lot of the stories in my book. I talk about Eddie's life really through my eyes, you know, and the similarities of our lives and the paths that we were on. And you know, since Eddie was my uncle and I started playing so young, I was friends with a lot of Eddie's friends, and I got to know Eddie not only from my relationship with them. I actually worked with Jerry Capehart longer than Eddie did.
Wow.
And you know, there was probably no other person around Eddie more during those critical years of his career than Jerry Capehart. He was around him certainly more than the family was. And he was around him in those circumstances where Eddie was actually doing his career. And so he saw a lot of the good and a lot of the bad, and was actually, you know, just part of the part of that dynamic. And I learned a lot about my family through Jerry too, because he found himself dealing with some of the problems that were going to rear their ugly heads later after Eddie's death, because decisions they made, I think, were not good for them. You know, they were fooled by people that wanted to fool them, and it's a shame that they sometimes let pride get in the way of good judgment. And one time they sent me a manila envelope, and scrawled on it was, "Bobby, sign this," you know, and underlined, and it was a contract for for a song. And it said, "For valuable consideration, you sign over all these rights for perpetuity." And the consideration was $1. And I called up Gloria and Eddie's older sister, who was kind of in charge of things over at Granny's house. I said, "Did you sign this?" And she said, "We certainly did." I said, "Do you have an attorney?" She said, "We certainly do." I said, "Who is it?" "No, I'm in the business. I know a lot of attorneys and a lot of names." And she said, "Well, the publishing company provides us with one." And I said, "Well, do you understand that's like putting the fox in the hen house to guard the chickens?" I said, "You need an attorney that's protecting your rights, not working for the publishing company. they had signed some terrible contracts, just some terrible, terrible contracts. And it's heartbreaking, you know, the greed and the fear, the pretending like you know something when you just don't, you know. And, it's not anything Eddie would have been happy about. Eddie dying at 21 was still a very young man, you know, and very inexperienced about some of the things about the business, you know. And by the time I met Jerry, I had a very long, successful career, you know, and as an adult, you know, for many, 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 many years, you know, certainly longer than Eddie played in his entire career, you know, and had a lot of record deals and a lot of things to learn from that Eddie never went through, you know. And of course, Jerry was doing the best he could at the time, but Jerry was afraid of people finding out that he didn't know everything, you know. And his defense for that was to act like he knew about everything. And if you were smart, you'd find out, well, that maybe Jerry wasn't right about something he thought he knew or wanted you to think he knew, you know. And that was a problem during Eddie's career, a problem with my career with him. And I love Jerry. He was a brilliant guy. Very, very, very astute songwriter and a production guy. His biggest weakness was just his insecurity. And we all go through that to some degree. And, you know, I think Jerry could have had a lot more success had he lived. He wound up dying from a brain tumor, a cancerous brain tumor, and boy, he died very suddenly.
How old?
I don't remember how old he was. It was in 98.
Hmm. Wow.
You could look that up.
So,
a long relationship.
Yeah. Was he also close with the family? So was there, like, any...
The family had a lot of bad things to say about Jerry throughout history, and some of it rightfully so, and some of it was just simply ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the family acts like they know me. They don't know me. In my life, my grandmother saw me play at two performances, too.
Wow.
The first gig I ever played was a talent show at school. The second gig was with Steppenwolf at, I think it was at UCLA, Royce Hall or something like that. She'd seen me play at home. I used to play for at home. Usually would wind up crying because it was a very tender thing, you know, to do some Eddie songs for her, you know. It was very personal to me, and I didn't tell people about it, but... Eddie started visiting me in lucid dreams as soon as I started playing. And in those dreams, he'd teach me to play and teach me about life and teach me about him. And although it could have just been dreams, or it could have been something that he was involved with, I don't have any way of knowing how to calculate which was true, but it certainly seemed real, more real than life to me. And the guitar just, in many ways, unfolded for me. It was as though I already knew stuff. Mm-hmm. And I practiced a lot. You know, four to 12 hours was not uncommon for me to practice for many times during my life. And I remember one time I was doing a session for Kim Carnes and her husband. I used to do a lot of recording for them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I can't keep this me centered in the camera.
It's no problem.
One time I was doing a session for Kim and her husband, and Baker Knight came to visit. And Baker was a famous songwriter. He wrote a lot of hits for Ricky Nelson, and he and Eddie were friends. And I was out in the studio, not in the booth. I was just practicing in between takes, moving around, and Baker came out to watch me. They were pointing out at me and talking about something. And so he came out to watch me, and he said, God, I only know one person that played that
those chords that way. And I said, who was that? And he said, Eddie Cochran. And I said, oh, Eddie was my uncle, and he about passed out. He turned white as a sheet.
Wow.
And, you know, people all my life saw similarities between Eddie and I. And it was a little bit uncomfortable for me, so I never told people
that I had all those visitations and those lucid dreams, because people were already whispering that it was like Eddie had been reincarnated in me somehow. And I, you know, although I loved Eddie immensely, and he was my biggest idol on guitar and singing, I just wanted to be my own guitar player too. You know, I started playing sessions when I was 14. My dad had a recording studio, and if people didn't have a guitar player, I was the guy in town. You know, I was there. You know, and so I play on a lot of different records, and I got a lot of pressure to play like Eddie did at times when I wanted to play something different. You know, and I liked a lot of artists like James Burton and B.B. King, and Jackie DeShannon turned me on to B.B. King when I was 14. Said your uncle was a huge fan of this guy, you know, listen to him, and I did. Jackie taught me some stuff on guitar that I still use today, and I have very, very broad influences. Of course, I knew Eddie was very much into Chet Atkins, and so I got into Chet Atkins big time when I was young, and learned a lot of stuff he did, and I always played by ear. Which is a good way to play. It helps you when you're picking things off records. It helps you to be able to listen.
Yeah.
And you know, so I got really good at that. I got good at wearing out grooves on a record, just popping the needle down at the right spot over and over and over. And it's a lot different than today, where you can slow things down however much you want and keep them in the same key. And, you know, you've got tablature and stuff to show you how something is played exactly, you know, exactly where it's played and with what fingers and how to pick it, and you got videos all over the internet. It's a different world, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty
crazy. But there's a lot of musicians wanting as far as their ability to listen. And you know, that was something I was gifted with, was, you know, I made a lot of my living through the years by being a critical listener. Helping companies develop guitars and amps and pickups and strings and speakers and, you know, effects, all the different things, and being able to critically listen and be truthful about it, you know. And there are a lot of people that say they can hear things that, you know, when I test them, they can't hear those things. And you know, I've been in a position to test a lot of people. Although I have a lot of hearing damage from all the years of playing and having an amp blasting in my head, I still have critical listening skills that other people don't have. Even though there are some frequencies I can't hear, there's a lot of stuff I can hear that other people don't. Mm-hmm. And that's just because of a lot of training, you know, and the kind of people I hung out with. And throughout my career, I'd find some genius that knew about electronics or speakers or amps, and I would be their guinea pig, you know, to test ideas out on and hopefully come up with something that I liked and that they liked and improve their products, you know. I started testing for Fender when I was 15.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a lot. So you, wow, that's kind of crazy. So your hearing isn't as good as it used to be because of that, huh?
Well, I play clubs, you know, 5, 6, 7 nights a week, you know, for many years, and toured all my life, you know, listening to sound levels that, you know, most people don't know what it sounds like to have 20,000 people scream at you,
mm-hmm.
Well, and your ears just crackle with the distortion.
Wow.
From how loud that is. I mean, it's louder than the jet plane, you know. It's a roar that's just simply unbelievable, you know. And playing as loud as we played, you know, full blast on stage, big stages, little stages, you know. And night after night after night in the clubs, you know, I have my amp tilted back right at me, you know. 40 watt amp as loud as it'd go. 100 watt amp as loud as it'd go, you know.
Yeah.
So I know I had hearing damage. I had a girlfriend when I was 18, and she tested my ears and said, "Whoa, you got a lot of hearing loss in this ear." That's where my amp was on that side. And but like I said, I can hear things that other people can't hear. I used to do a lot of loading of my ammunition. I was into shooting, and I could load about 300 rounds an hour. And one time I ran out of powder and didn't realize it. And I had a box full of shells. And I didn't know which ones had powder and which ones didn't, but I could shake them. I couldn't hear it in this ear, but I could hear it in this ear. I could hear the powder shake. And I could hear when there was no powder, apparently, you know. So I found all the ones that had powder versus the ones that didn't have powder and reloaded those bullets. And I made a mistake on a few shells, but, you know, it was pretty clear that I could hear them over here, but I couldn't hear them over here, you know. And I still have trouble hearing people speak because it's in those sibilance ranges where the difference between a D and a B and a M and an N and an F, you know, F versus S, you know.
That's crazy.
You can hear this. It's S. Sounds like F.
Yeah, that's wild. So, well, hearing is one thing, but what about sight? Did anything happen with, like, the stages, lights, I don't know?
No, that stuff's all pretty normal. I had great eyesight.
That's good.
I was about 45 or 50, and eventually I had to have cataract surgery because I had an illness several years before that caused cataracts.
Mm.
And it caused premature cataracts, so they replaced my lenses, basically, with artificial lenses. So I can't adjust my vision for close up and far away. But I have, in one eye I have 20/20, and the other I think I have 20/15, which is excellent, you know.
Yeah.
And there are some artifacts, you know, just from aging, you know, that you get, you know, little floaters and stuff like that that show up every now and then that aren't necessarily a big deal. But I also do a lot of healing type of thinking, you know. I have a book coming out about language, love, relationship, and spirituality. And in the book I talk about how we use a lot of words unconsciously. And subconsciously that has an effect on how the world turns out. When we're speaking about our life and thinking about our life, we use language, mostly. And in order to describe a picture or a movie you see, you do it with language. And when we're speaking, a lot of times we use words that, if we really thought about it, we wouldn't use that word. You know, the word "but," you know, "I love you, but whatever," sounds to the person who's listening like maybe you don't love them.
Yeah.
The word "but" rules out what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't use it like that. They talk about something they love and they say "but," which rules out that they love something. And then they talk about some other thing that may also be true, but the fact that they've ruled out the important part of the conversation, which was what it started with, is catastrophic in communication.
Definitely.
You know, if you tell your wife, "I love you, but," what she might think is, "To what degree don't you love me?" For whatever, you know. And that's not what was intended. You know, so people use language, in my opinion, frivolously. I go into much deeper explanations about it in the book. I was explaining that to an 8-year-old and her mother, and the 8-year-old, as soon as I explained that, she said, "God, I could." the idea was I want to go to the beach, but I have to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that they wanted to go to the beach was ruled out in language with the word but. So the little girl says, God, I could do my homework at the beach. I didn't think of that before. You know, when you don't rule it out, I want to go to the beach and I have to go to work. Now you think about, oh, what can I do to still go to the beach? Instead of ruling it out and just going to work, you know?
Right. Huh.
And it's a very simple lesson or observation. And also, people use a lot of words like, I have to do this, I got to do that. I must do something, I need to do something, I should do something. People are always telling people as they're growing up, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. When in fact they're doing something else, you know. All those words are disempowering on a certain level, possibly. And what I teach is that if there's something that's important for you to do and you find yourself saying I have to do it, that's like putting blinders on so you can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
And when the course correction comes, since you decided that the course you were going to take has to be this or must be that or should be this or needs to be that, those blinders keep you from seeing the course correction that shows up. And people often wind up at a destination they didn't intend, and they wonder how they got there. Well, my proposition is they got there through language and through words and through ideas which sprung forth because of the language and the words they were using. So let's say that you got to go to work. Well, If you wanna make a living, yeah, maybe you do gotta go to work, so to speak, or you have to. However, when you go to work with an attitude of I gotta do it, I need to do it, I have to do it, you can be resentful about having to do it, and not respectful and grateful, as it would be if you were saying I get to go to work.
Yeah,
that's a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Having to is not a privilege. It's not. In fact, you don't have a choice if you have to.
Yeah, I guess really when you think about it, it really does matter what we're saying because it kind of changes the way we even think about it.
Yes, and in the Bible it talks about that God created all of this with a word.
Mm-hmm.
He brought it into being with a word. Let there be whatever, you know.
Right.
And whether you believe in that, it still is an important observation that words are important. And when we're listening to somebody, we listen through a perspective that includes the cliches that we have added into our language. And when we listen to somebody, we interpret what they're saying often by adding meanings that weren't there, by saying a cliche instead of the actual words they used. And so if you ever played the game of telephone where you whisper in the first person's ear, then they whisper in someone's ear, and then they whisper in someone's ear, by the time you go through 12 people's listening, you can't even recognize what was first said.
Right. Yeah.
And that's one of the problems with the Bible, for instance. That's one of the problems with oral history, is people add their perception to the oral history, which changes the oral history. And when you go through generations and centuries of changes, well, that's not the same thing as what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there are books out now explaining how the worst eyewitness is an actual eyewitness sometimes, because they see it through the filter of their perception. And sometimes they see a black guy when it was a white guy, or a white guy when it was a black guy. And you see regularly people that were found guilty, and you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years later, they find out, because we have DNA now that can be evaluated, that the person was never guilty. But the eyewitness and the prosecutor and people's perception causes things to not be the way it actually was. And that's a lot of what my book is about, you know. And when you're in the process of healing, it's important that you pay attention to what you say. You know, someone says, God, my foot's killing me. Well, is that the result you want, that you're going to die because you have a footache? This situation that broke my heart is killing me. Is that really what you want? I understand that you're heartbroken, your anguish is deep. State that, not that it's killing you. because you may bring on a result that you didn't intend. Like I said, we wind up at a destination that we never intended, and we didn't know how we got there because we were frivolous with our language, frivolous with our perspective, frivolous with our perceptions. So rather than listening to a person and repeating what they actually say, we repeat what we think they meant. And if you ask a person, what did I just say, when they repeat it back to you, they will almost always not get it right because they listen through a perception.
That's crazy.
That's the way life is, and we wonder why life is as messed up as it is. Well, it's because we've got a lot of people running around speaking in a way that isn't in alignment with their authentic purpose in communication. They use cliches instead of saying what actually happened. I had a friend I was life coaching, and she said her relationship with her husband annihilated her. I said, well, you look pretty good to me for being annihilated. Beautiful woman. I said, well, let's look up annihilated and see what it means. And it pretty much is completely destroyed. And that's not true hardly ever. You might be incredibly hurt and sad. You know, I was singing a song, Since I Fell for You by Lenny Welch, one night. And it's like the light bulb came on. And what people usually say is the light bulb went off. Well, that's not what you mean. It's like you're in a dark room and the light comes on. It illuminates the room. It didn't go off.
Right.
You're in the light and a light bulb goes off. What does that mean? You know?
Mm-hmm.
What they meant that came on, you know? And so I'm singing a song and it says, love, love, bring such misery and pain. And I thought, that's not true. Love never brought misery and pain. Love is phenomenal always and forever. Every single time, love is great. It never brought misery and pain. That song, love hurts, love hurts, love hurts. They say it over and over in that song. Love doesn't hurt. Love is incredible. But they don't say that. I know what they mean. When you love deeply, you open yourself up to potential deep hurt by betrayal, by lies, by, you know, those things hurt. Betrayal and lies hurt. By abuse, narcissism, you know, you can be hurt by a narcissist. Not because they love you, but because they don't love you. Because they don't have those emotions. You know, they're all concerned about themselves, you know. They invite you to their masturbation party and ask how was it for you, and they don't even care. You know, it's crazy. You know,
that's bizarre. It makes me also think of like jobs like lawyers or doctors who specifically change what you're thinking, or that's what their whole position is. Their angle is to change your mind or your perception of whatever it was. You know, political people as well. It's kind of crazy when you think about it like that as well.
Well, an attorney, one of the amazing things about attorneys is they're very specific about their language.
Mm-hmm.
That's what a huge part of their training is to be very, very specific about the language. To say you may do something means you can do it or not. To say you shall do something means you shall do it.
Right.
Those two words are immensely different, and the misuse of those words could be catastrophic for you. And a doctor, they're trained the way they're trained. They're not trained about nutrition hardly at all. They know very little about nutrition. Even many nutritionists don't know the latest and greatest about a lot of nutritional ideas. And we have a medical world that's all based mostly on pharmaceutical promotion. The way a lot of schools survive, and the way a lot of doctors survive, is by being supported by the pharmaceutical world. And so when a person is taught to visualize healing to the tiniest, most 3D technicolor detail, that's very different than being told that you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
They plant the seed that you're incurable and that you're going to die. And if you don't do what they say, you're going to die. And even if you do what they say, you're going to die. That's what they told me. You got 9 months to live. Get your papers in order because you will never improve. That's what they told me in 86. And I finally realized that I didn't want to die and that maybe my doctors were killing me. What I discovered is that if any doctor ever tells you that you're incurable or that you're going to die, then you have the wrong doctor if you want to get well. Because all of their patients die in their experience with the condition they're dealing with. So if you come to somebody that says, well, yeah, the statistics are that you could die from this, you know, in a very, very short period of time. However, what I teach is miracles. I teach that we're all capable of creating miracles. You know, in the Bible, although I'm not religious anymore, I was taught that Christ was teaching us that anything he could do, we could do and more. That's essentially what he was saying in the Bible. Yet people pray, let me first add that Christ also said that the kingdom of God is within you. Everybody's looking out there. You're going to go to someplace. Heaven or hell, you're going to go to it. I'll tell you, I know a lot of people that are living in hell right here on earth. And I know a lot of people that live in heaven right here on earth. When you're making love to the woman that you have just totally opened your heart to, and vice versa, that's heaven. I don't know of anything any better than the birth of your child. You know? For most of us. There are some people that just, you know, they're different.
Well, sure.
Narcissists, they don't have that empathy gene. It got yanked right out their butt, you know? Pulled it out at birth. We've got a whole country full of these powerful CEOs and government officials that they say are our leaders. They're not our leaders. They're supposed to be our representatives. And they're supposed to lead in representing us. That's not what any of them really do, either on the left or the right. We've got a bunch of scoundrels willing to get away with what they can get away with at times. And, you know, it's interesting that oftentimes the Republican Party is not saying what they're going to do for the poor people and the middle class and all that. They're talking about protecting the interests of the wealthy. Whereas the Democrats are often talking about, even though they don't follow through on a lot of it, helping the poor rise up to the middle class and the middle class rise up to the upper class. But we've lost the course of direction to get there. You know, we no longer have a society based on a tax structure like we had with the Eisenhower era, where the wealthy were taxed huge percentages once they got past a certain amount of wealth. We still had wealthy people, extremely wealthy people back then, but we built a middle class that had second homes and vacation homes. Could take vacations, and now they're still fighting about a $15 minimum wage. And I saw recently that one of the representatives was talking about his 1970s job at minimum wage, and they said the minimum wage then brought up to now, considering all the inflation, the way houses have increased, would be $25 an hour. Or thereabouts, as opposed to 15, which that won't happen until 2025. It's not even going to be right now. And I don't know anybody that can truly live on minimum wage right now, or at $15 an hour. $25 an hour is even difficult.
Well, another thing actually is where you live. So, you know, in like California, yeah, it's a $15 an hour. Or places in, like, I guess, what is there? In different, like, states, it's cheaper. It's a lot less. Some places are, like, $7 an hour.
Cheaper to live here in Nashville. Uh-huh. You know, I see the differences.
That's true.
However, you suffer the weather, and you suffer some of the ignorance of, you know, people that just have not traveled much more than 100 miles away from their home all their lives. And you've got generation after generation of people like that.
Mm-hmm.
That really are still living under the rule of superstition. You know, it's just like when you visit a caveman, you know, and about darkness, you know, and it's a different way of life. They have, you know, every society, no matter where it is, has some kind of God and some kind of belief system of good and evil. And religion no longer has the place in society that it once had. It doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. It just doesn't have the power that it once had. Religion really at one point became more about money and greed and power as opposed to true salvation. And, you know, I think Gandhi said it very wisely. He said, that Christianity is a beautiful religion. I just don't meet many Christians that are Christ-like. You know, and with Trump's ban on Muslim people, you know, I've known Muslim people that are beautiful people, just incredible people. And it doesn't matter to me what religion they are. You know, when they honor the golden rule, which to me is a fundamental way of life, you know, it's to a large degree what Christ was teaching. When you teach love and openness and connection and empathy, life is rewards you. It's in so many ways, it's its own reward because it engenders a kindness in us. And so much of our language is used in a way that it disconnects us from what's actually important to us. If I say I have to do this interview with you, well, there's almost nothing I have to do. I have to breathe or I'll die, but my body takes care of that. You know, if I don't go in the bathroom and go to the bathroom, then I'm going to make a mess where I am, you know. But I don't have to. I can make a mess if I want. If I get to, it's a whole different world. That's a whole different world. If I get to have you as an interviewer as opposed to having to have you as an interviewer, it's a different world. Mm-hmm. I can come to something willingly and with openness and with a freedom that I don't know, you know. I've come to a point where when I use a word incorrectly, it often feels so different when I correct it. You know, like if I say, I like you as an interviewer, but whatever, you know, like anything after that. Or I like you as an interviewer, and I can have the same comment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I still get to like you as an interviewer.
Yeah.
As opposed to you feeling like, subconsciously, even if it's not conscious,
mm-hmm.
like, well, what's wrong with me? Or what's wrong with the interview? You know, which was never intended.
Right.
You know, and that's there everywhere in life, every single day. Pay attention to how often you use the word but. And think about whether the word and would be more appropriate, or if the word however, or in spite of. There are other ways to state it that are in alignment with how you feel. And there's not this subconscious conflict going on. And can you imagine how much conflict, inner conflict, is going on and we're unaware of it? You know, we're completely unaware that we're unaware.
Yeah. You're really opening my eyes in a lot of different ways. You know, I've never really thought of it like that when you, I guess, just English or just words. But it's crazy, actually, just the way that we perceive things, just how someone else would say something. That's crazy, just the thought.
I use a lot of this in my master classes and clinics. I was doing a clinic down in, or a master class down in Mexico, and at the beginning of the thing, they were talking about, well, how do we advertise? We only got a day or two to advertise. And I said, let's do it as a master class on relationship. And during that master class on relationship with guitar, if you bring your partner or a friend, they get in free. And at my master class, I had a psychiatrist that was 70 years old and retired. And she was, you know, interrupting with questions constantly, very interested in my ideas. And very much in agreement with me about the things I was talking about. And she said, now, she kept talking. So I said, you and I would do well to meet on another day where we have some hours to talk and share. So I met with her for about 5 or 6 hours on the following day, and she shared with me that her specialty was multiple personality people. And she said she discovered through blood tests that in one personality they had a disease, and in the other personality they didn't have the disease. And she took that to the board of people that govern that type of psychiatry, and they thought she was crazy. However, the head of the board said, well, I'm going to go test some of my patients. You know, you bring up some interesting things. They came back and said, you're correct. I've proven what you said. So imagine, in a multiple personality person, they usually don't know about the other personality, right?
Yeah.
And in one personality, you've got a disease, and in the other one, your belief system alone causes you not to have the disease. Now, isn't that a miracle?
Yeah, that's awesome.
Mind-blowing. And yet you haven't heard about that probably because you haven't heard about it. You know, the pharmaceutical companies have nothing to gain with their business structure the way it is. They've got nothing to gain by really curing us. They have everything to gain by keeping us on their pharmaceutical products. And when people, like the one that came up with polio cure, decide not to charge and not to patent their cure so they can make a profit on it.
Mm-hmm.
They do it out of the kindness of their heart. They share their gift with the world. We all have a necessity to have food and water, place to live, and a certain degree of comfort would be nice, you know. However, our society is not structured in a way that it was a problem when Reagan closed all the nutcases, all the crazy people that were housed in these places were put out on the street, and our homeless population exploded during that era. And when I've got a friend who's got a 100% cure for PTSD, but the VA won't even listen to he and his partners to hear what they've discovered. When the VA is part of the lack of action about Agent Orange being a problem for all those troops that were subjected to Agent Orange, we have a new problem. All our troops that went to the Middle East in all those wars were subjected to depleted uranium poisoning. Depleted uranium is what was in those shells that penetrated that armor of Saddam Hussein's huge army, you know, his military mechanized force, all his tanks. So where do you think all the depleted uranium that wasn't used up in the explosion went? Well, it's just like this coronavirus. If I breathe out coronavirus, what happens to it in 10 minutes? It travels as far as it travels, be it 6 feet or 100 feet, depending on the wind, and then it falls to Earth just like gravity makes everything do. And who's talking about coronavirus on the floor? When? When do they ever talk to you about that? Everywhere you walk has coronavirus if there have been coronavirus people there. So it's on your shoes. It could be on your clothes. Who is promoting showering when you get home, taking your clothes off? And showering and putting clean clothes on and washing those clothes. And cleaning and sanitizing your shoes. So you walk into your house, masked up, and coronavirus on your clothes and on your shoes. And we wonder where we get coronavirus eventually.
Right.
Well, they're talking about what they're not talking about. You're not aware of what you're not aware of. It's not that this stuff is complicated. It's very simple. However, it can be complicated. We can make everything complicated by not paying attention to what we're saying, by not being in alignment with our actions, with our heart and soul, with our actions. Recognizing when we're out of alignment with our heart and soul. When you're unaware that you're unaware, how do you make a decision based on all the information? People are out there making all these decisions when they're unaware that they're unaware about really important stuff.
I I think, honestly, it also has, it kind of comes down to, I guess, back to, I guess, politics and just, again, like you said, preferences and what we see. Because, like, news sources, they aren't really going after the stuff that we don't notice. Because, I guess, maybe they don't even notice it themselves. Or maybe the people that are in charge of that don't even really, I guess, care. Because that's not what's interesting, you know? That's not what news is, you know? That's not what gives them their shows.
So much of the news was about what he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of what he was saying was often fake news, which he was accusing everyone else of.
Sure, yeah.
And then we've got a whole bunch of people that believe that since Trump wasn't a politician, that he wasn't bankrupt morally the way the politicians have demonstrated that they are. Well, in fact, Trump demonstrated how morally bankrupt he was throughout his entire career. People just weren't aware that they weren't aware of it.
Right. Sometimes.
And they didn't want to believe what Trump called fake news.
Yeah.
And he just propagated these lies over and over and over to where people actually believed it and believed that we needed an insurrection at the Capitol. And then we've got a bunch of senators that decided that he was not going to be found guilty because they had an agenda. Didn't mean that what he did wasn't what it actually was purported to be, was encouraging craziness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the world has never been as crazy as it has gotten since Trump, because the things that he has said has allowed people that were on the fringe to come out and think that maybe their ideas were in the mainstream. When we've got 75 million people voting for this guy, all of those 75 million people are not bad people. They are misled to a large degree, as are many Democrats. However, I find the Democrats are at least talking about some ideas that are about raising up the middle class from falling into the poor class and getting the poor class out of the ditches. You know, even a $15 minimum wage is appalling to me. When you work a full-time job and that's all you make, you can't afford hardly to live anywhere with much of a life.
Right.
It just is not that much money. And when we've got an economic structure that causes the house that I bought in 1970, I believe, which was $21,500, to suddenly be worth close to $600,000. And my pay scale has not even gone up to half as much as that increase. I used to be able to pay my house payment with 2/3 of 1 week's pay. Who do you know that can do that that isn't wealthy?
No one. And that's just so annoying.
All families have to be two people.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all homeowners, unless you're wealthy, have to be two people to afford that payment.
And, well, the other thing also you got to realize is you're getting paid that $15 wage, but you're also getting taxed. So it's not even that $15.
And Biden, who was the best that the Democrats could do somehow, there were clearly people that were more forward-thinking than him, which I was in favor of. But he was the one that got the support of the country, so I voted for him. Even though he was one of the people that was that promoted and got past taxing Social Security. That's appalling to me.
Mm-hmm.
It should be one of the first things he reverses now that he's got the power to do some things with a wave of a pen. And I hope some people start talking about that. My God. Social Security for most of us isn't enough. And when the unions are based on the corruptness of what the unions became, which was based to a large degree on the corruption that was caused by the war on alcohol. When they decided that didn't work and they ended it, when they ended prohibition, that had started, it already put into business all those gangs. Well, all those gangs that were now in business that we put into business by our ignorance
mm-hmm.
now have an organization.
Before I continue my conversation with Bobby, I'm going to have a quick sponsor right here.
Which we're now faced with in the war on drugs, which is a totally fake war term. It was never a moral war. It's caused our prison population to just explode to where we have more people in prison than any other country in the world. And it's mostly black and Hispanic. And it's mostly young. Black and Hispanics. And Biden was part of that get tough on crime stuff. I imagine it was part of that three strikes you're out, which was ineffective. You know, a lot of times what we did was we took somebody who was a criminal for doing drugs, made him a criminal when it was really a societal problem, an emotional problem, a mental problem. The fact that they can't make enough money to live on, oftentimes. Yeah. The fact that we allow broken homes to exist the way they do. The fact that some states don't even recognize child abuse as what child abuse is. You know, you can spank and beat your kid. You can verbally abuse them, and it's not against the law. You know, some states have laws against it. It's not against the law for a husband to verbally abuse his wife. You know, to cause a wife to have PTSD and to want to kill herself, you know? It's not against the law.
The law system is like a completely different story when you think about it. Again, with like the prison thing, and it, going back with what you said before. Hold on, I'm sorry, I have a call. Hold on. What you were saying about, well, taxes and, you know, having a low wage, you could literally go to jail for something like tax evasion and actually be kind of screwed because of that. And it's all, I guess, really politics and also, I guess, what we vote for in a way.
Well, we've been doing it for generation after generation.
Mm-hmm.
What the Republican platform was back in Eisenhower's days, you would think that was the Democratic platform.
Yeah.
You know? And what the Democrats were doing back in the days of slavery, you would think, well, shit, that's not what Democrats do now, you know? But they've completely reversed policies, you know? I remember back in high school, there wasn't a time that I was particularly fond of all the people running for class office.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my friends were not like those people, you know? And a lot of times I wouldn't have wanted that person on my team. You know, right now, there are very few Democrats or Republicans that I would want guarding my back in a fight. Most of them are spineless. Bernie Sanders is different. However, the ignorance of Bernie Sanders to continue to call himself a democratic socialist, even using that word, is like poison in our society, because we have too many ignorant people that don't understand the difference between socialism and communism. They think it is the same road. You become socialist and then you become communist. And a democratic socialist, most of them don't discern the difference. You know, how about becoming a golden rule advocate? I'm an advocate of the golden rule.
I'd support that, yeah.
That's a worthy calling.
100%.
You know, and the golden rule would treat poor people like they were worth something, as opposed to doing what both parties do. You know, right now the Democrats can't pass a $15 minimum wage because they don't have enough votes in their own Senate. I think we had 10 people that objected to the vote on the Democratic side, in addition to all the Republicans. You know, the Democrats have demonstrated repeatedly that they've got problems in the ranks. And it's probably 90% of both parties are just horrible human beings, in my opinion.
I can agree to that. It's kind of crazy how we've gotten to this point now where we're almost kind of so divided where it's like a 50-50, either you support this or you don't support this, and we fight over the tiniest of things, when really the people on the top are the ones that are winning because us lower people are the ones that are fighting over it, you know? It's crazy. It really is.
Well, both parties have been, to a large degree, corrupted by Citizens United.
Mm-hmm.
If the Democrats don't get rid of that by making laws against what that allows, then we're going to be saddled with it until they do. Gerrymandering, you know, it's important that they eliminate gerrymandering in this country.
Mm.
And, you know, they should be able to make it a federal law. They've destroyed so many of the things that were done in the 60s. You know, how is it that a representative like John Lewis has such a tiny voice in this country when his message was so profoundly important to everybody that cares about people? And he died holding on to a lot of the values that he held on to when he was being arrested and beaten, and still maintained a generosity of kindness, and empathy towards people that's remarkable. And how is he not immortalized in a way that would extinguish somebody like Trump ever having a chance? You know, there was a point when Trump was first running where the Republicans thought it was a joke because he was so unworthy of the position. And suddenly, they're ass-kissing everything he does. You know, when the Tea Party came into being and we had assholes like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Mark Levine who's that other guy, you know? He realized he was part of the destruction of America when he was supporting all these super right-wing Tea Party views. Glenn Beck, you know? And here they all are supporting Trump, saying that it's a hoax, it's not a terrible virus, it's no more than the flu or the cold, you know? And convincing people that are ignorant enough to believe them that it's crazy to wear a mask. I ask anybody who believes that way, if I have coronavirus and I'm infectious, would you rather me have a mask on when I'm about to spit on you or not? Would you want a social distance or double that or double that and wear a mask if I was about to spit on you? You'd have to be stupid not to want to wear a mask.
Yeah.
And that's what we have, Texas and Mississippi, you know, in Tennessee. You know, they're opening up places when we still get half the country is still susceptible, over half the country is still susceptible. And even with the coronavirus vaccines that we have right now, they've proven that they're not very effective against the African version and sometimes even the British version. And that means even if you've gotten both shots. So would you rather be wearing a mask and have me wear a mask if I'm about to cough or spit?
Well, I always hear a few of the arguments. One of the main one was always like, you know, the percentages are always low. But like, that's also kind of because of the people that are wearing the masks, you know. It kind of shows how effective it is.
It is because of whatever is causing it to be the way it is. We don't know all the answers, but an intelligent person knows that if I'm about to spit on you, you'd rather have a mask on me.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter about all the statistics that we've heard and lies that have been told on both sides. If someone is sick with this virus, and I can tell you because I had it, that it is nothing anybody wants. And to hold out and to act like it's an invasion of your privacy, your rights to freedom, to cause you to have to stay inside if you don't have to be out, which is just a sensible thing, and to wear a mask if you are out, and if you've got a family member that's sick, man, keep them in the other room. Get a damn HEPA filter so you're filtering your air all the time, because, you know, if they're down here by the intake vent for your air conditioning, and that virus is going throughout the house. And if I go out into public and I'm unaware that my feet are picking up coronavirus, wherever it could be, because that's where it falls. That's the way gravity works. You know, and if you're too stupid to understand that, well, you're too stupid to be in charge of my kids anywhere. You're too stupid to be a teacher. Too stupid to be one of my representatives in government. You know, they don't give these people an IQ test, a suitability test. You know, Trump would fail practically every sense of honor there is, as far as I'm concerned. The things I've read and watched about people that he's taken advantage of, it's no different than the American people, really. He has lied to us and lied to us and lied to us. You know, and that for me, that means I don't care if he's got any good ideas. Get him away from anybody that he can influence. I don't want him being part of what my son looks up to, or my daughter. You know, the fact that he acknowledges that he talks about grabbing women by the pussy, grabbing their tits whether they wanted it or not, or kissing them whether they wanted it or not. And then he's got, like, how many of them have sued him over this shit? You know? He's a despicable human being.
He really is, yeah.
Anybody that is an evangelist or a religious person has violated an unspoken oath to follow in the footsteps of Christ. I don't say that to all my religious friends, you know.
Sure.
But, you know, everyone has their right to believe what they believe, and sometimes I would rather be able to have a conversation with somebody who could not hear the truth about some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I chose not to have an argument with my son the other day when he was saying he agrees with the guy in charge of Texas opening up because businesses need to open up. Well, how about this virus wouldn't have killed 500,000 people in America had our president not called it a hoax and spent the rest of his time in power not supporting the best ideas about getting rid of this virus, not following what Japan and what South Korea and what New Zealand and Australia and so many other countries did to get the rate down to zero when it was flourishing around the world. Our president was an ignoramus.
Yeah.
And most of our representatives are spineless. They're spineless. And it's a shame.
That's kind of just how society is now, honestly.
You know, listen to any of these people speak and listen to how often they say but after they say something. Listen how often it happens. Just ruling out what they just said that was good over and over and over and over. And then telling us some whatever. We've been being indoctrinated by both sides as long as you've been alive, as long as your parents have been alive, as long as your grandparents have been alive. We've been being indoctrinated by people in charge, you know, and following a path of one or two choices that we wound up with no matter how stupid it was. You know, it's like...
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a lot to take in, but when you really start to think about it, it does. It does a lot.
We use but so unconsciously.
Mm-hmm.
We use I have to, I must, I need to,
mm-hmm.
I got to, so unconsciously. And it's dictating where our path is going.
It really changes your whole perspective.
Yeah, so awareness is the great gift.
Yeah.
And now that you're aware, it's important to become aware of how you're still not aware. So you can do something about it. Because otherwise you've got no choice.
Mm-hmm. There's always room to improve. There's always...
All your choices are based in the fiction that you've been saying and causing your perception to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying just you, but everyone.
Sure, yeah, I understand that, though. But I wanted to say, yeah, we've been doing this. I don't usually have my... usually it's around an hour. I try not to keep it, like, extremely long. But, thank you for doing this. This was really interesting. This was really enlightening for me as well, actually.
Well, and we were barely talking about music.
I know. We barely started, and then a whole different tangent just completely changed it. But you know, I like that. I honestly, I like when the podcast isn't so specific to one thing, and it can continue into a completely different conversation.
I was doing an interview with a British magazine, and prior to the video, the interview,
mm-hmm.
we got into the subject matter. We talked for 2 hours, and she was crying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's suffering from cancer.
Wow.
And in our speaking, when we're causing the possibility of cancer getting worse as opposed to the healing of cancer,
mm-hmm.
that's pretty important. And so we did the interview. We wound up doing enough of an interview that they included it in two magazines.
Wow.
We didn't talk about any of this other stuff during the official interview.
Yeah.
But I saw that they came out with another Eddie special,
mm-hmm.
and had another complete interview with all stuff we hadn't talked about in the first interview.
That's really cool that they can separate it from, you know, the musical aspect and then more of the political stuff.
You're welcome at some point to complete an interview.
Yeah,
I mean, if I just spent time talking about the Flying Burrito Brothers, we could take the full hour.
Definitely, yeah. When you really go over the whole analysis of what happens in
life. If I just
life.
Talked about producing a Green Legs award-winning albums.
Mm-hmm. I think we should definitely chat again, definitely have another section where we do this, another segment. I think it would really be exciting. But I really enjoyed this. This was great.
And it was a 3-hour segment, and I was supposed to do an hour.
Mm.
We did a full 3-hour segment.
Wow.
And another DJ was in the room. He says, I need to have you on my segment too.
Yeah.
There's so much good stuff to talk about, you know. I did an interview
right.
one time about surf guitar and sounds.
Hmm.
You know, they wanted to have me back just alone. I was with three other people doing an interview about surf guitar and the sounds and stuff, you know. And he wanted me back, which we haven't done, you know, to just talk about surf guitar and the sounds. Because at 15, I was helping Fender develop the sounds that were being used in music, you know. When I was first starting out, surf guitar was all the rage, you know.
Mm.
And so I have a lot of experience in that world, and the country world, the rock world, the rockabilly world, the blues world. You know,
yeah.
Eddie was. It's been rumored that B.B. King said that Eddie was the best white blues guitar player of his era.
Hmm.
That's a good compliment from one of my favorite guitar players.
Yeah.
I was honored to get to spend. Quite a bit of time with him and with BB and Mike Bloomfield when I was about 16. I don't remember where I was, but I got backstage and sat with him, and we were discussing vibrato, and I was developing my vibrato at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Two of my idols right in front of me, as close as you are to this camera, you know.
That's crazy. I can imagine.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I appreciate the calling, and
this was great.
I hope you edit it so that it's powerful.
Well, honestly, sometimes I want to edit it, but there's so much that I want to keep in, you know? So
yeah.
I end up very, very little editing. I sometimes barely do like 5 or 10 minutes out of like a few hours of, you know, content. Or even
yeah.
like this one. It's 1 hour and 20 minutes, I think, we've been doing this. And who knows how much I'm even considering actually taking out, you know? But, yeah, I really appreciate this. This was great.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, I won't keep you any longer.
All right. Bye.
All right. Bye. So that was my conversation with Bobby Cottram. I hope you all enjoyed. If you'd like to see more of Bobby, you can find him on his Facebook page, Bobby Cottram, and his website, which is bobbycottram.com. I upload episodes every month and sometimes even more. And if there's a song or artist or even group that you want me to talk about or talk with, you can contact me on Instagram, AJ's/analysis, or by email, AJMusicPodcast68@gmail.com. I'd love to talk about any old music and all old music. But yeah, that's it. Thanks for watching. Peace.